We are talking about high density. Isn't there also a place for quark gluon plasma?
Quark gluon plasma? Yes. So, I can use the diagram that Misha wished he had here to point to. The quark gluon plasma is that QGP part. It's all up there, right? The bit that, however, neutron stars tend to be colder, neutron star mergers as well tend to be colder, and they're in the region where there might be quark gluon plasma, possibly. I mean, I drew the neutron star merger region there below this red phase transition into some ordered phase, but it might not be. It might be that the temperature gets high enough that you get quark matter that is not ordered, and you could get some quark gluon plasma in a merger. That's possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, so Avanis Bastisharma from NICIF. I have three questions. So the first one is, what does the coefficient in the equilibration rate depend on, and can we calculate it from first principles?
The coefficient in the equilibration rate? Let's see now. You mean which equilibration rate?
You showed some, I can't say the slide because you don't have the slide numbers.
This is probably not thermal conductivity, this is probably the density oscillations. And so my guess is that you're talking about
Maybe this one, yes. The C over there.
You're probably talking about this gamma here, the internal equilibration rate.
And then the coefficient of it, so the C?
The C, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I didn't say this. The C is just, it's what people call susceptibilities. It's derivatives of the free energy.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. So it's things like how much does the chemical potential change when you vary the density at a constant entropy or whatever, you know. It's a combination of things like that follow from the equation of state. Now, we don't know the equation of state at the densities and temperatures of neutron star mergers, but we can. There's a variety of models that sort of span the plausible range. So to within a factor of a few, you can have a reasonable guess at what the value of that coefficient there is. Now, this rate gamma here, that's what the rest of my slides were about. You calculate that from the weak interactions. Mm-hmm. And so the weak interaction part, you can calculate accurately, right? There's no doubt about the weak interactions. However, any sort of dressing that comes with it to do with the strong interactions, like when I showed modified ERCA with a spectator nucleon having a pion interaction, it depends on strong interactions, and that introduces some uncertainty.
Okay.
So parts of this calculation are just weak interactions and are pretty cut and dried, and parts of it involve the strong interactions, and then there's uncertainties of typically less than a factor of 10, but a factor of a few, associated with the fact that we have some reasonable founded expectations of how matter should behave, nuclear matter should behave at a few times nuclear saturation density, but it involves sort of extrapolating descriptions from lower down where we have more experimental data, so those extrapolations have a bit of uncertainty in them.
I guess you're also in the non-perturbative regime then for the strong interactions.
I'm sorry, say it again?
You're also in a non-perturbative regime for strong interactions.
Yes, I guess the definition of a strong interaction is that you're always in the non-perturbative regime for strong interactions.
Unless you want to do calculations, right?
So these models are in some way spanning a range of plausible behaviors for nuclear matter, but you're not claiming to have a Feynman diagram-based description of all the nuclear matter that's in there. You're using some model with quasi-particles that you assume are weakly interacting.
Right. So the second one is, how much do we lose, how much accuracy do we lose when we use the non-relativistic approximation for the sum of the matrix squared elements?
Yeah, okay. So the only reason that I showed the non-relativistic expression for the matrix element was to fit it on the slide. We use the relativistic matrix element. Okay. There was an earlier paper where we used the non-relativistic one, but now we use the relativistic. Because it's not that different, it's just I wanted something that would fit.
Okay. So the last one. So at some point you talked about two regimes for your theta function.
Which function?
So for some theta function in the latter part of your presentation, theta du, what's it called? A step function, one of your step functions.
A theta function?
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So you had two regimes for the first one was for like your the momentum of your Fermi neutron was like smaller than the sum of the two later ones, and then the ones the one where it was larger than. But do you ever consider the case where it's equal?
Okay, so you're talking about this.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what's the question?
Well, do you ever consider the case where the equation is equal?
You mean when
larger or smaller than, but yeah, at equality?
Well, that's a set of measure zero, so it's going to contribute a negligible amount to the integral, because you're integrating over the momenta, right? Mm. I skipped over it. But here, you're doing an integral over the momenta.
Yeah.
So there are certain special regions,
yeah.
But it doesn't matter what you can think what you like. You can put anything that isn't a delta function, you can put on a set of measure zero, and it will...
I guess it needs to be defined at that spot as well, right? There are different conventions for that.
Different conventions for
the theta function.
Yes. Yeah. Again, it doesn't matter what you do with the theta function. Right at that point, it doesn't matter what you do with it. Mm, right?
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Other question behind you? Yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So we always talk about in spiral, right? And in the very unlikely event that you get a head-on collision of two neutron stars, what would happen? Like, it would look more like a heavy ion collision, so maybe you move up in temperature?
Okay. Well, so astrophysically, I don't think there's any scenario where you would get that, because your binaries always have angular momentum, right? That's the way they are. So that would also be a very, 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 very unusual event. But okay, let's imagine it. So some neutron star happens to be zooming along, smashes into the other neutron star. Would that be significantly different from when they're going around each other and they merge? I mean, I can imagine it being a bit different, but I don't really see any reason why it would explore such a different region of the density temperature phase diagram. It might be a little different, but I could imagine there would be differences, you know, based on maybe the initial impact being different, that little region where it first touches being different. Instead of a scrape, it's a plunge. Okay. It's a fun thing to think about, but I don't think one would be able to get a paper published on that.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe there's like a three-body kinematics.
Oh gosh, you're synthesizing all the talks that we've had. That's
but
fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose if you had three things, then you could end up with like the second Mars neutron star falls into the Sun neutron star, and yeah, okay, maybe yeah, that's an interesting thought. Okay.
Hi, Christian Döring again. So maybe you said it and I missed it during the talk, but maybe can you then maybe remind me, these density oscillations, they always stay constant in amplitude, or can they also grow, or?
They tend to shrink generically. So we had somewhere, at the beginning, I showed these tracers where the people doing a simulation tracked fluid elements and watched what happened to them, and they experienced high amplitude density oscillations in the first few milliseconds, and then medium amplitude density oscillations in the next sort of 10 or 15, and then it settled down to what one might call low amplitude. These are like maybe, or do they look to me like maybe 5 to 10%, 5% density oscillations going forward there. That's what they saw in this simulation. So you can see the amplitudes, you know, they vary, but there are some quite big ones.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Can you please remind me, so how did gamma actually depend on the temperature?
Yes, so let's see if I can go forward again to where we calculated the equilibration rate. So what we wanted was this little gamma. What I gave you was big gamma, and I didn't tell you how they were connected, but they're connected in a fairly simple way. So here's the rate, and when we calculated it, bum ba bum ba ba. Let's see. This thing, that's interesting. It doesn't have any powers of the temperature in it. That might be a misprint, because there should be some powers of the temperature in that rate. So it's possible that I missed out some T's. Ah, well spotted. Yes, there it should go like some power of the temperature. Well, maybe one can work out dimensionally what it should. Actually, dimensionally it looks all right. Okay, I'll have to. No, it doesn't look all right. Okay, it's missing some T's. My guess is there should be a T to the fourth there or something like that to reflect that phase space. So yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can I maybe also ask one more question? Okay, so you mentioned on the last slide the beyond the standard physics thing. So could you maybe tell us a little bit more about that and about nuclear pasta?
Wait a minute, those are two totally different things. So in the last slide I showed, I had this sort of final bit of like the masala and dessert at the end of the day, which was just meant to leave you with a sweet taste in your mouth. So yes, so this is just the fact that I don't want to go over this slide again, really. It's just saying that if you've got axion-like particles, they're weakly coupled particles, and they can play the same role that neutrinos play. You know, they get created in the star, and then they interact weakly, so they just zoom out, taking energy with them, and they can be a cooling mechanism, a radiative cooling mechanism. And what Stephen Harris and his collaborators, including me, found out was that if the coupling was about what the maximum that's allowed by the constraint that it mustn't mess up supernova 1987A, and if the temperature was really, really hot, then you could find that it would cool a little hot region to about half its original temperature in 10 milliseconds, so it could be a considerable amount of cooling. So that was that. Are you asking me a follow-up on that, or did you just want me to re-emphasize it? Okay. Nuclear pasta, which I guess I foolishly mentioned somewhere in here as a thing. Okay. So nuclear pasta is a phase. So in a neutron star, before it has a merger or some other violent encounter, it's in layers, right? Like any spherical gravitationally bound thing. And on the outside, at the very edge of a neutron star, the pressure is zero, right? At the top of the atmosphere of the Earth, the pressure is zero. So at the outside of the neutron star, the pressure is zero. So you, for a little tiny sort of sliver of layer, you have something vaguely like normal matter. And then as you go in, it gets compressed, and you get more and more compressed matter, but it's still got separate nuclei. And then at some point, the neutrons start to leak out of the nuclei because the chemical potential for the chemical potentials are rising. There's more and more electrons outside. The electrons start going into the nuclei and combining with the protons and making more neutrons. So these get very neutron rich. And at some point, the neutrons leak out, and then you've got a sea of, so we're looking at layers as we go into the neutron star. You start getting layers where it's all neutrons with little proton-rich islands, which are where the nuclei were, right? At lower densities, higher up in the star, there were actual nuclei. As you compress it, at some point, you've got a sea of neutrons with proton-rich islands, which are the remnants of the nuclei. And if you keep compressing it, you find that those proton-rich islands can start combining and making threads, which you call spaghetti, or making plane. Let's see. I guess they can make planes, which you'd call what's it called, lasagna. And so these are the nuclear pasta. There are various ways in which you can arrange the proton-rich regions in their neutron ocean. Okay. And so why does it form these interesting geometric structures? It forms these interesting geometric structures because there's a battle going on between electrostatic forces and surface tension. Okay, and so you always get interesting forms of ordering when there's a battle between two different sort of tendencies, and then you can get lots of different, what do they call them, allotropes or something in chemistry, right? Different crystal arrangements. There's some battle going on, and so in this case, there's this battle going on between the electrostatic forces, which are trying to spread the charge out because they don't want to concentrate charge because that makes electric fields, and surface tension, which doesn't want to have too much of a boundary. So it doesn't want lots and lots of little drops of everything very spread out, very diffuse. The charge, the little, you know, if it was just up to electrostatics, it would say, let's have tiny, tiny little bits of protons spread out everywhere. But there'd be lots of surface tension. Each of those droplets would have a surface. The surface tension is saying, let's glom them all together into a one big volume and with the minimal surface to volume ratio. And these two things fight each other. And out of that battle come all different geometric arrangements. And those are nuclear pasta. Okay, have I answered your question?
Can I really quick ask, can you make nuclear, like, gnocchi?
Yes. So the nuclei, so the first stage I described with proton-rich blobs that used to be nuclei, that's a form of gnocchi, right? I didn't mention that you keep going, and then at some point the whole thing flips, and then it's all sort of proton-rich with little neutron, little proton-depleted regions, right? You go through the inverse series where now it's all proton-rich and you have proton-depleted threads and proton-depleted planes and proton-depleted droplets, which correspond to sort of inverse lasagna and inverse spaghetti and inverse gnocchi. It's very cool. You should look up the literature on this. It's great. I've never contributed anything to it except admiration.
That sounds delicious.
Just very quickly, I was looking at the conclusions now, and the last point is still beyond the standard model of physics. Is that something else except from axioms, or?
Okay, so the only bit that I've had anything to do with is this thing with axion-like particles. But I know that Stephen Harris and Bhupal Dev and some other people looked at scalars, exotic scalars, and they've published at least one paper on how those scalars could influence neutron star phenomenology, and other people have looked at dark matter, how dark matter might get trapped in neutron stars and change how they behave in some way or other. So there's a whole subset of the literature that is interested in these sort of questions. I was just sort of pointing to one aspect of it.
No done. More questions, not even over culinary nature. Thank you very much, and thanks, speaker, again.